This is Love Your Work. On this show, we help you make it as a creative, find your unique voice, find the right mindset to succeed, be the first to capitalize on new opportunities, to make a living making your art. I'm David Cadavy. If you want to join us here on Love Your Work every Thursday, please hit subscribe on your podcast app. And if you want the very best of Love Your Work, if you want the gems I have discovered in my thousands of hours of research into history's greatest creators, all in a short weekly email, sign up for my Love Mondays newsletter at cadavy.net/Mondays. How would you feel if you got fired today? If the answer is relieved, you might want to rethink your job. Robbie Abed is author of Fire Me, I Beg You, Quit Your Miserable Job Without Risking It All. Robbie is also one of the early influencers on LinkedIn's publishing platform. He's had over 500 coffee meetings, and he's one of the key catalysts, along with James Altucher, behind why this podcast exists at all. And you're going to hear the story in this conversation. I took a short visit to Chicago and sat down with longtime friend Robbie Abed. In this conversation, you're going to learn, if you're thinking about quitting your job, what is the one question you should ask yourself to know if you should pull the trigger? And how do you quit your job without committing career suicide? And Robbie says, never lie on your resume, but lie like hell in your exit interview. Find out why. Here is Robbie Abed. All right, I am here with Robbie Abed. We're in the lobby of the Moxie Hotel in Chicago in beautiful River North. And Robbie, this was your idea to be in this booth.
It was my idea. It only took us 45 minutes to get this set up, but I think it's totally worth it.
I mean, they've got a beautiful little podcast booth here. You might be hearing some music in the background because it's not totally soundproof. Nobody working here knows anything about this booth. And I think we're probably the first people to ever use this booth.
But I mean, they did get a lot of PR. I mean, the only reason we found this was because of the PR. So
it's
from a marketing move, super smart.
Well, it's decent equipment and we did get it to work. So
yes.
That's good. I was talking to somebody earlier this week and I was like, oh, I'm interviewing Robbie Abed this week. And they're like, who?
Right.
And I'm like, yeah, he wrote Fire Me, I Beg You. And he's like, what? I don't know. And like, well, he had 500 coffee meetings.
Uh-huh.
And he's like, oh, okay. Yeah, I know that guy.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So you're better known for 500 coffee meetings
right.
than you are for Fire Me, I Beg You. So
yeah.
Why did you have 500 coffee meetings? It just sounds like the seventh circle of hell to me.
Yeah. So thanks for the flattering introduction, by the way. And you've also, so it's actually 250 coffee meetings. I mean, I've had 500 coffee meetings, but the thing I go with is 250 coffee meetings a year. 500 would be insanity. Can we swear in this thing, by the
500
way?
500 sounds better. Yeah, you can,
yeah,
you can
we'll go
swear.
We're going to go 500. It's fine. But the Google 250 is the,
It doesn't have the same ring to it, but.
Yeah. Let's just go with 1,000.
Let's go with 500.
Yeah, 500. So the question is, why did I have so many coffee meetings? You know, I do a lot of things. When I quit my job and became an entrepreneur, I knew nobody. When I say I knew nobody, like I knew fucking like nobody. And so,
why did you know nobody?
I mean, I had connections with my job when there was like this enterprise IT consulting. I knew people there, but when I quit to do like real technology work, you know, entrepreneurial type talk, no, like they're two totally different worlds. So when I came to this in the Chicago community, I realized I was like, oh, there's nobody I can talk to. There's nobody starting companies that I know. There's no mentors that I can, you know, that I can connect with. And I literally had no idea how I can like meet people. And so coffee meetings was a great way for me to just get connected with people, understand what they're working on. And I didn't really have a plan in place. Like, I didn't know how I was going to make money from these connections. I just liked talking to people. And to this day, it's helped me sort of, you know, build business. I've got clients from that and things like that. But I did out of pure desperation to build my network.
Were most people willing to have coffee?
They were once I had some sort of like connection in Chicago. And so if you're familiar with Technori, I got started with Technori and started helping them.
A local tech location
where we had keynote speakers and startups sort of pitch their idea to 500 plus people at Chase Auditorium. Yeah. And so I got involved helping the keynote speakers kind of set up their talks and help these startups founders, get ready to have a great pitch. And so I use that foundation to say, hey, you know, instead of like, hey, you want to have coffee? Let's talk about what you're doing. Maybe we can help each other. And so I started there and then I started just expanding out. So now I can start reaching out to other random people. Right. What I realized is that I needed some sort of physical connection first. I needed to meet them face to face. And then after I met them face to face, I sort of went for the coffee meeting kill to schedule a meeting in the next couple of weeks to have coffee. And so once I met them in person, my success rate was essentially 100%. I mean, nobody said no. Now I can reach out to some people cold and say, hey, I want to connect for whatever reason. And I have the background, you know, they look at my LinkedIn profile and things like that. Like, oh yeah, let's connect. But before I had no real reason for anyone to connect with me.
Oh, you were like one of the first big LinkedIn influencers too. Like you were one of the first big publishing, or when they opened up their publishing platform, you were getting all these 500,000 view, posts that you were putting up. And then they flew out a camera crew and made a promotional video of you walking around Chicago.
Right. Yeah, which was an amazing experience. So when LinkedIn, this before LinkedIn had any, like, you couldn't create any content on LinkedIn, really. Maybe like post a photo or whatever. They started creating like this long form LinkedIn content, like blogs. And I was just an early contributor to that. And I just started using that platform to start either republishing myself or writing new content. And because there was like nobody writing anything, as opposed to now where like everybody writes something, I just was able to sort of like hack the algorithm to just show up on people's feeds. And so I did that, and that's how I built my email list and things like that. But I totally used that to my advantage, and then that's how I got the video.
Do you still know how to hack the algorithm?
I do. It gets harder and harder, you know, because...
Well, you have to tell us. You have to tell us how to do it.
Oh, so what's the secret? Yeah.
You have to share it with thousands of people.
Yeah. Please. So I struggle with it. There's the hack, which is like, here's how you get more views and comments, you know, but does it always mean like people are going to respect you? Like the people that you want to respect are going to respect you more. So it's kind of like, it's very clear you're sort of doing it. So it's like, it's funny, like so LinkedIn, I call like, it's like inspiration porn or like, you know, it's like, what's the word I'm looking for? Where you like project something like the right thing, like virtue signaling. Mm-hmm. Like I hired a homeless person when nobody else would. And now I gave them a shower and a bath and a job. And now they're the executive of a great successful company. People will like that shit all day.
Yeah.
And so it's any like,
and it's probably like not even true.
Now he's looking at it, it's like, yeah, it's, you look at it and go, it's probably not true, but people love it.
You know, wow. So anytime, but you would never do that.
I would never do it now. I mean, I knew before how to do it, but like, I would never hire a homeless person, David. That's exactly what I said. Yeah. Way to put words in my mouth. No,
you would never write untruthful things on LinkedIn.
No, I would, you know, I'd make things sort of, I put a good story around it.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's really anything that signals that you've done something different, or you gave someone a raise or a promotion, or you didn't fire someone when everyone on your team told you to fire them. That's like the lowest common denominator of like hacking the LinkedIn algorithm.
It makes you wonder if people are ever going to get just desensitized to that sort of thing. Like, don't enough people look at that and they're like, okay, I see what you're trying to do here. But
I think that yes and no. It's kind of like what you've seen. Like, I think we reached a point where we're too in our own thoughts and things like that. It's kind of like you know, Tai Lopez or someone else like that. Like you and I or other people that go like, what, you know, how the people fall for this.
Are they seeing what I'm seeing?
Yeah, they see what I'm
seeing. What is going on? Yeah.
And so, but then we recognize maybe we're just in a different world than everyone else. And maybe what he's saying is really resonating, but it's we're at a different time in our careers and lives where we don't necessarily need that in our lives.
Yeah. Well, he said to use the Lamborghini to get people in to like, then get them some other message that is important or whatever.
Right, exactly. And so a lot of people love that. And that's why some people hate or love Gary Vaynerchuk, mm-hmm. you know, things like that. And the people that I've noticed, the people that are really successful, you know, they look at Gary Vaynerchuk like, eh, like he's like, I don't really buy what he's doing, but everyone else is like, oh my God, I needed this guy in my life. Mm-hmm. You know, he's the best thing ever. And I've started to understand too, that it's also impacted the way I write. When I used to write about quitting, yeah. You know, fire me, I beg you.
Which we'll get to. I mean, I do want to hear your story about how you stalked James Altucher, because yeah. It has something to do with how we ended up on this podcast
right.
at all. So yeah. Let's start with how you stalked James Altucher and had coffee with him.
Yeah. So if you don't know James Altucher, I'd say he's called him like a prolific writer. He's one of the few people that still writes. I think he writes every day still. And so when I quit my job and I was lost and I started writing every day and I didn't really know who he was. I really caught on to his writing style and I just became like a huge fan right away, because I think what I loved about him and his writing was that it didn't seem like there were rules to his writing. It didn't follow like 5 best practices for writing. Like I didn't like, cause I was looking when I started early, I was like, well, how do I write? Like, what is my sentence structure? You know, can I say this? Can I not? And I was like, after I read his post, I was like, well, shit, if he can say that, then like I could start saying things that are more true to the way that I want to write. And so he changed my writing like overnight, you know, and I had to meet him. And so it became like my life's mission to just like meet with James Altucher. So long story short, it took me about 3 years and I sent him emails. He'd respond and he wouldn't respond. And then I tweet him and then he wouldn't respond. And then one day I was going to New York for a wedding. And I told James like, hey, James, I'm going to New York. Do you want to have coffee? And surprisingly, you know, he's like, hey, let's do it. I was like, great. He goes, but I'm in upstate New York. And I found out later on that he didn't think I was going to go upstate New York, because it's like a 3-hour drive. He's in the middle of fucking nowhere. And so I said, fine. And so I'll do it. And so the day's getting closer and I'm trying to confirm the date and time. And it basically took me some tweets, some follow-ups, some emails. And I finally met him after renting a car in Manhattan, driving up to the middle of nowhere and meeting him at some local coffee shop, which is like middle of nowhere coffee shop. And then I ended up doing a podcast in his home. He came over. He's like, hey, it's great. He's like, I looked at your profile. You do 250 coffee meetings a year. I said, yeah. He goes, you want to do a podcast? And my home, I was like, yeah, of course I'll do a podcast. There was never a plan to do a podcast. But I think maybe I'm the only person to do a podcast in James's home.
Well, this is his Ask Altucher podcast, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So there's a way old years ago.
Yeah.
Episode with Robbie on Ask Altucher.
Right.
If anybody wants to hear that. Cool. So can we talk about why I have a podcast and how James Altucher is involved in that?
Yeah.
Is that publicly shareable information? Like James Altucher is going to be paying attention and be like, I'm suing you because that made me look bad.
Yeah.
Because
now that I think about it, he's the reason you have a podcast.
Yeah. Well,
title of your blog, but he's the reason, really. I'm sort of a conduit to that, but
conduit, yes. Conduit,
yeah, whatever. And that's why I don't use that word ever. I don't know why I decided to use that.
Maybe I'm using it wrong.
No, if someone's using a word right, it's probably you. And if it's wrong, it's me for sure.
100%. I don't know why that would be, but okay. So wait, how was it that my podcast exists because of James Altucher?
Yeah. So long story short, we had the podcast, and then he was on a. He had a podcast sort of network that he was on, and they were still in the process of considering like creating like a podcast network. Mm-hmm. And this is years ago, so I think I talk about it. And so his producer's like, "Hey, you want to be part of the network?" And he gave me some of the rules and things like that. And I was like, "Yeah, I'm thinking about it."
So you've never had a podcast before,
never.
And the producer of this network is just like, "Hey, Robbie, do you want to start a podcast in this network? How does that work?"
Yeah. So
why did they pick you?
I think they picked me because when you listen to the podcast, he was like, oh, this fits perfect with like the choose yourself type of thing.
Uh-huh.
So like the firing and quitting and you know, things like that. So he's like, this is perfect for James's audience, his style. And I love the let's, you want to do that? And so I said, let's do it. And so he sent over some podcast equipment when in the office that I was in. And that time you were in Chicago at the time, and you were just sort of, you know, you'd work out of my office every other day or something like that. And then we start talking and you were like, yeah, maybe I should do a podcast.
And they didn't just send some podcast equipment. Like they sent speakers. Like, I don't even know why you need speakers to have a podcast.
Monitors,
like, supposedly so you can hear the podcast that you recorded in a context that on which nobody listens to podcasts. Like, nobody listens to podcasts through speakers. I mean, than like a nice stereo. Not, I mean, that's not as important.
It was for more editing,
It's more important to listen to your podcast on like crappy white iPhone headphones or something. But like, they sent some sort of a, I didn't know what this equipment was at the time, but like the arms, a lot like what we're talking on right now. There's like the arms, like really high quality microphones.
Just professional shit. Yeah, absolutely.
Like monitors, like headphones, and then the digital audio interface with like all the these mixers, sliders on it, the mixer, you know, and there's like it was like a lot of equipment to send to somebody who's never had a podcast.
Right.
And then you interviewed me for your podcast.
You're right. So you're trying to rub this in. So I never launched that podcast. I've been about four or five people. I never launched it. And what's funny is you and you're getting to this is the, you started a podcast because, you know, you were like, oh, you're sort of, I guess, inspired by what I had.
Or I was
your
inspired.
Podcast envious.
I was inspired, and to your credit, you were like, you just start the podcast. Like, I've got this equipment here. Yeah. Just start the podcast. Like, just do it or whatever.
Yeah. And at the time, I was like, yeah, you should. And I don't know if it was your, I don't want to take credit for your ideas, my ideas, but I think it's when you interviewed Jason Fried, I don't know if I was like, hey, you should just talk to like Jason Fried or something. I think you reached out to him on my own, but there's a few like Steve K. So I was like, you should reach out to
you.
That was my,
that was that you.
One. Yeah.
That was you. Steve K. Because you're like, hey, he's got this AOL, book coming out. You should reach out. And I'm like, Steve K. Are you kidding? Wow. That's like, Steve K. is, I mean, it's funny because younger people are like, who the hell is Steve K.? But Steve K. was God to me, you know?
Right. Yeah.
He started AOL, which basically changed my life. As far as I'm concerned, he started the internet. And so, you gave me that idea. And then, I did a few interviews with your equipment. I mean, my first interview was...
Oh, you did actually use my equipment.
Yeah. My first interview was in New York. I was on a mini life there, spending a month there. And I brought my equipment sort of thinking like, oh, you know, maybe I'll start. And so, I sent an email to Jonathan Wegner of TimeHop and had my first interview there. And then I interviewed Adrian Holvati on your equipment. I interviewed Saya Hillman on your equipment.
Oh, great. Oh, in the office.
In the office, yeah. Oh, okay, she came in the office and I interviewed her. And I think Jason Fried, I interviewed then, like, he might have actually been like the fifth interview I performed or the fourth.
Yeah, it was very early on, wasn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, but he was the first episode.
Oh, when he launched it.
Yeah, so I kind of got to practice a little bit with not Jason Fried, people who I wasn't going to be quite as nervous to talk to. And then I got to Jason Fried and then wanted to make a statement launching with him being the first guest.
Yeah,
so
that's a great launch.
So it is all thanks to you. And, I mean, I don't want to bring up these painful memories of things that you like wanted to start that you didn't get to, but I've got tons of stuff like
now
that.
Now I'm on this podcast. Like, yeah, I can do this. I think if anyone's listening about starting a podcast, I think the way to think about it is if you're not going to create 100 episodes, like if you don't really plan on creating 100 episodes, like don't do the podcast.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think so.
I don't know. Really? I say have permission to do one episode if you want.
I mean, if you can take it,
if you can do one episode and you can not feel bad about yourself for not doing more,
right?
I say go ahead and do the one episode.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Like,
but you would do one episode even though you don't know if you're going to do two episodes.
I think it depends upon your own personal psychology and the way that, you know, your own motivational judo moves, what will work. Mm-hmm. But I like the story of Drew Ackerman of the Sleep With Me podcast, who he basically, I think he tells a story on the episode where I interviewed him, mm-hmm. but he was basically saying like, yeah, I was telling myself, okay, well, I'll do, I can quit after 2 episodes. And then I told myself I can quit after 5. And then I told myself I can quit after 10. And then I told myself I can quit after whatever. Then eventually I said, well, okay, well, let's do this for at least 3 years. Right. And then it was 3 years before.
And then he ends up in a Moxie podcast booth.
Yeah. Yeah. He ends up trying to find, unplugging ATMs to plug in the equipment on the podcast booth like we were about to do.
Yeah. I was
gonna push it next to the bar, just like
I'm pretty sure that's how like police get called, like unplugging a box with a bunch of money in it.
I'll tell you how police get called. Police get called by having a podcast booth and not having anybody who knows how to use it or has any idea.
Or maybe it's people who are trying to sketch famous paintings at the Art Institute.
Right. Well, I mean, this is part of probably why I was feeling a little rebellious, because I was just in the Art Institute. And I got chided or yelled at, castigated for sketching. Mm-hmm. I was sketching on a moleskin notebook. And anyway, so it was...
He was a little bit too good.
I was like, I'm sorry, you're going to have to physically remove me while I'm sketching if you want me to stop sketching. That's what I didn't say. I don't know what the French word is where you're like walking down the stairs on as you leave the party and you think of what to say. That was that. Mm-hmm. That was not what I said. So let's do talk about Fire Me, I Beg You, yes. And how to quit your job and give people something useful to have right. this conversation. I'm always worried when I talk to somebody that I'm really good friends with because sometimes you listen to two people on a podcast who are just having a really good time.
Yeah.
And you're not having, you're like, yeah, I'm not having nearly as good of a time as you are.
Oh, another inside joke. Thank you so much.
Yes, thank you so much for this inside joke. Or like you're laughing. They're laughing and it's really what they're laughing at isn't funny. The only reason why it's funny is because they know each other.
Right.
To them. And I don't know, maybe some people like that stuff. There's obviously some shows that do very well that way. But okay, so you wrote a book called Fire Me, I Beg You. Mm-hmm. And I've recommended it to my listeners and my readers a number of times. And I've had a lot of people like thank me for recommending the book too. Yeah, yeah. They're like, oh, wow, this is so awesome. Like I read that book. It changed my life. Mm-hmm. I had at least one person who said that.
Mm-hmm. I'll take it.
Yeah. Not bad. Right. So how do people usually react when you say that you wrote a book called Fire Me, I Beg You?
It's either one. It's opposite ends. There's the one people that like don't get it. Like, why would anybody want to quit their job? That's dumb.
Worse than quitting, getting fired. Worse.
Yeah. Well, a lot of it's, they just don't understand why you would do anything different than the job that they have. And then there's the other end, which is like, oh my God, you came in at the right moment. Your book changed my life. That you're exactly what I needed. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. You know, like I get emails. When I was really promoting it, I got emails all the time like, they fired me. Like all caps, they fired me. Thank you so much. They fired me. It's like,
okay. Like the emoji with the confetti after it.
Yeah, exactly. So it's usually the opposite ends. And when I wear my t-shirt, which I'm wearing now, my Fire Me, I Beg You t-shirt, when I walk into places, a lot of people would like look at it and go, oh, where can I buy that? Like, oh my God, like they'll all the time.
Really?
All the time. And it's always retail workers. When they see it, they're like, they'll call all the coworkers like, oh, I would love that shirt. Like, oh, they're like, oh yeah, we need that so bad. Anyone was like, I went to like a diner at 2 a.m. and the waitress is like, oh, that's it. Bartenders.
Wow.
You know, people were working I remember I went to a Cubs game and one of the like vendors there, one of the ladies, she was like, all of them were like, they're just laughing. They laugh. That's one thing is they laugh.
Uh-huh.
You know, there's people that are like miserable with their job, like careers, you know? And then there's like, oh, I don't like my hourly job.
Yeah.
And the people that like my hourly job, they laugh. People laugh like, oh, that's funny. You know, and I'm like, I wasn't trying to be funny, but thank you. You know?
Well, yeah, I guess it works. I mean, you're striking this nerve in them. That's something that they want.
Right. Yeah,
I mean, well,
they
secretly want. And actually, yeah, that's something that I secretly wanted once when I was working in Silicon Valley and I was becoming dissatisfied with my job. Mm-hmm. I mean, I guess maybe I wasn't as I didn't realize how dissatisfied I was until they did fire me. And then I was like, yay, yeah. I'm never working for anybody again. Right. And I had already set a lot of ducks in a row to be ready to go do my own thing.
Right. And that's the metric to figure out if you should quit or not.
Oh, okay.
The question is, how would you feel if you walked into work and your boss fired you?
Okay. So this is a little mental exercise for everybody who's listening right now. Do what, you could call it mind sculpting, which is something that one of our recent guests talked about. So mind sculpt this. You picture your boss comes over, says, hey, I need to talk to you, leads you down the hallway to this conference room. Mm-hmm. Your boss is holding this manila envelope that's sealed. And you're like, oh, what's in that?
Yeah.
And what's the rest of it look like?
Yeah. And so, so if they, if they say, hey, this isn't going to work out, let's say, hey, you good time here, but we can't afford you, or, this is just working out, like today's your last day. And if you can imagine that and you just imagine yourself, how would you feel? And if the answer is relieved, then you should quit your job. So if you imagine that scenario that you laid out, you go through that and they said, hey, you're no longer working here. And if you feel relieved, then that's the answer.
But I mean, isn't that dangerous advice? You just told people to quit their job. Am I going to be personally responsible for everything that happens? Those that who are just like, oh yeah, so I'm $200K in debt. And I listened to your story. I did the mind sculpting and
you're like my family. My family said, like, one of these days, like, the police are going to show up on your door again. How dare you? And I used to be in the middle. Like, there's a Kanye West meme. Like, I give you this advice, but, I don't want to ruin your life, And now I said, you know what? Screw it. I'm going to say, if you're not happy, you should quit your job, because I recognize the people that aren't going to quit. I've got friends that should have quit their job 10 years ago. I've been screaming at them, like, fuck, quit. You're so much better. You're so much capable. They don't quit. So my advice only works, I recognize, for people that are on the edge.
Why do you think your friends should quit?
Well, they're miserable people. It's the same job.
They're miserable people.
They're miserable at their job. They have more potential, And they're always talking about. Every single time I meet them, they always talk about how much they hate their jobs.
Yeah.
It's the same one. And they don't, the problem is they don't feel like there's another way out. And so they just stick with it until someone tells them you can't do this anymore, or like the entire industry collapses and says you're no longer allowed to do this.
I mean, I wonder, part of it is also that it's a lot easier to complain about quitting your job than it probably is to quit your job.
Right. A lot easier. And so you need to, and it's hard because you don't know what's next. And another reason why people don't quit their job is because there was so, and I did a survey to my email list, and I got about 1,000 responses. And I asked people, you're miserable. I mean, you've joined an email list called Fire Me, I Beg You. Why haven't you quit? And the number one answer, and this is a free form text box. It wasn't like, oh, choose one. It was like, you type whatever the hell you want. And like 60, 70% of them said, I'm afraid my next boss is going to be a jerk. That was their number one answer. I'm afraid that I might not like my next job.
Uh-huh.
I'm afraid I might not like my manager. And that's the reason they don't quit. So they're miserable now, but they're afraid. So
it's not money.
It's not a lot of times paying it's not
the
money.
Bills. No. I mean, I'm sure that those show up a lot.
Yeah.
But actually that they are catastrophizing this idea in their brain that, like, it just can't. I mean, I can think of the same sort of thing. Yeah. I mean, you can think of the same thing with like a relationship. Oh, I don't want to break up with this person because, I can't do better.
Yeah. And so I think people struggle with visualizing what's next. And if they don't know what's next, I think they get crippled and don't make decisions.
So there is, they're afraid of what's next. I mean, as I was talking about how it's easier to talk about quitting your job than it is to actually go do it too. It's like, it if you are just talking about quitting your job, then you can fantasize about all sorts of great things and how you're being held back and how you're so talented and how you're so much more capable, and you can continue to believe those things, but you don't ever have to face up with the reality of
And there's just a lot of people that are just, they resent the system that they're in.
Yeah.
You know? And so, and they just talk about this all day. They have WhatsApp groups of everyone complaining about, you know, whatever their issues are. And
so there's like pity party WhatsApp groups for people who just...
A lot of it is just like, so specifically like pharmacy, pharmacists, you know?
How do you know about that?
They're all mostly miserable people. My wife's a pharmacist, but my wife loves her job. But the other people...
All the others are
the others of them. No, I mean, it's the, I think it's just, it's their, they don't feel like there's another way out.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, imagine you studied, you know, you did the bachelor's and then you got your doctorate, you did all this work, and then this is it. This is what you're doing.
Sunk costs.
Right. And also skill set. They don't have a skill set or the certifications or the other things they need to do, other different things.
They've already gotten off at the on ramp, at the off ramp, and they've realized they're at the wrong exit, but there's not another on ramp. They've got to like get on some country road that's not even paved to like get to the next on ramp.
Yeah. And so they just ride it out until one of these days, you know, one of these big companies comes and says, we've automated 80% of this. You know, thank you for your time type of thing. I think men, they're just waiting.
So what should somebody do in a situation like that if they have all this training and what they've decided is the wrong thing?
You know, we'll go back to James Altucher. There's one piece of advice that he gave that really stuck with me. He goes, if one person can make a major decision and ruin your life, then you're doing something wrong. Right. And so for example, if their boss told them or the industry say, hey, they're not doing it, then they're doing something wrong. And the answer is, the real answer is you've got to figure out something else. You've got to build your skill set in something else that's marketable to allow you to get out. You're going to need at least like, I think like, you know, 2 years or so to like make that transition out, but it's got to be very intentional.
Yeah.
To get out of that sort of system.
Well, this brings up the whole idea, like if you're going to quit your job, maybe don't run in to work tomorrow and do it. There might be some preparation that we need to do first. So how can people prepare to quit their jobs?
Yeah. So a lot of people think like fire me, I beg you, it's just about just say screw everybody and quitting. And it's actually the exact opposite advice. I said, like, you know, figure something else out, figure out different streams. That's why I take coffee meetings, is because I'm constantly trying to learn like what's out there. What do I need to do? Who are the people that I need to meet? Who are the people that could potentially provide me opportunities?
Dig your well before you're thirsty. Plant your garden before you're hungry.
Yeah. So those are the things, meet as many people as you can. And that's why I use coffee meetings and build a real skill set. I mean, I think the internet has allowed us to build skill sets on our own. Like we don't need permission to code. We don't need permission to design. We don't need permission to do marketing. You know, these are things that we can easily, I want to say easily, there are information out there to help us do these skills, but it requires our own effort and recognizing the piece of paper we have is essentially worthless. And so once you understand, and that's how we lead open my book, is essentially that there's two reasons you're reading this book. One is you're miserable, but you can't quit because of finances, or two is you're unsure of what's next. And you are playing a life game of musical chairs. And the music is going to stop. Either you get out now or you just wait for the song to end. And that's the way that I sort of frame it. It's like the first page, literally. And so, and it's kind of like a scare tactic of the world is going to end. But, you know, that's the reality of that. So that, you know, figure out ways to get out of that before you have to.
But I mean, isn't the popular wisdom, you got to go find another job before you quit your job? What do you think of that?
You can. I mean, it all depends. So it all depends on your financial situation, where you are. So the more you go up the traditional chain. So if you're single, you know, live with at home something, then take all the risks you can. You know, then you get a girlfriend or a boyfriend or whatever that is. then you got to take like a little bit less risk, and then you get married, and then a little bit less, and then like once you have kids, then it's like you have way too many people to take care of, or that your chances of quitting to explore opportunities are essentially become really difficult. You know what I mean? So long story short, if you don't have any liabilities outside of yourself, then by all means quit, explore, and do these opportunities. It's a good chance for you to figure out what's next, because you can live off of ramen, you know, and things like that. But more responsibilities you have, then for 100% find a new job. But you still have to sort of explore to see what that is.
Is there a certain like amount of savings that you feel like a person should have before they quit?
You know, I think it's it depends. Yeah, I think the minimum is 6 months. I'd say that. If you have a year, that's great. 2 years, even better. But 2 years, it's difficult for almost everybody. But you know, I'd say like a minimum of 6 months to 12 months. It all depends on like how confident you are in going back. So when I quit, and I mean, not many people know this, but when I quit my job, I didn't really succeed. You know, I didn't make the money. So I went back to a previous job.
So when you quit your job, was that the time when you discovered that you wanted to be fired?
Yes.
How did that happen?
How did it happen when I decided to, longer wanted to work?
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's one of my, very similar to what we were talking about before, but you know, my boss set out a calendar invite for, the title was Catch Up. That's all it said. No description, nothing. But she sent it like 2 o'clock in the morning for the next day. I'm like, fuck, I'm like, that's, she sleeps at like 10 o'clock. Like, what is she doing? Sending this vague invite that says catch up.
And I'm going to fire you.
And that's all I was thinking about the entire night. I didn't sleep in the morning. I'm like, she's going to fire me. Like, this is it. It's over. You know, like my savings are, you know, I got to go dip into my savings. It's my last day. And then I asked myself just two questions, which is, what do I want to happen? I'm like, oh, I hope she doesn't fire me. And what do I secretly want to happen? I really hope she fires me. Like, fire me, I beg you. I'm miserable. End my life. You know, and that's it. But she
So by the time you get to this meeting, you're thinking like, all right, she's going to fire me, but also please fire me.
Secretly. But okay. I still didn't want her to. It was one of those that I didn't want her to fire me, but if she did, it'd be like a good cut for me to leave.
Yeah.
And so I show up, and then she starts talking, but then she starts talking about wanting to catch up on like tasks, activities. And like halfway through, I'm like, but Joanne, I thought you're not going to fire me. She's like, no, I'm not. Why would I fire you? It's like, you're doing a great job. I go, oh, I thought you were going to fire me. Cause like you did this, like, please don't ever send me these vague calendar invites, you know, like wait till the morning or grab me, you know?
And by the way, I quit.
And then I quit 2 months later. It was kind of like, I quit because I was like, you know what? I finished my duty of like the sort of project I had to do.
Yeah.
After that, I was like, I had some time to think. I was like, you know what? Maybe I should just become an entrepreneur.
Uh-huh.
And then I left. But I'm still friends with a lot of people that I wrote the book, and we joke about it.
Yeah. So how do you quit without committing career suicide?
How do you quit without committing? That's a great question. I don't think it's ever career. It's only career suicide if you decide to do nothing. You know, like if you quit and you decide to go on vacation, 100% career suicide.
Even Jerry Maguire had a career after he quit.
Yeah, well, I haven't watched that movie in a while, but yeah, if he did, I'll take your word for it.
Well, he made a scene.
Yeah.
You know, said, who's coming with me?
Mm-hmm.
Stole a goldfish in front of the entire firm. I mean.
I don't think I've watched the movie yet, actually.
I mean, it is just a movie.
I've used the meme of show me the money like a million times, but I've never actually watched a movie.
You millennials.
So, yeah.
Okay. Well, so, but how do you quit in a way that's respectful?
Respectful, yeah.
Of you, what your boss's obligations are, or maybe there's gradations here.
Yeah, so I think there's multiple ways. So I think that, you know, to your original question, like, you know, is it career suicide? If you quit and you're learning new skills, you're meeting new people, you're doing something else, you've created another area of opportunity that you can explore on. But you can always go back. I've gone back to jobs to work full time again because it didn't work out. And so the expectation that once you quit, you'll never be able to go back in the industry, you know, unless it's like, I don't know, maybe it's Hollywood or something. I don't know. But 9 times out of 10, if you have a good background, they'll take you, a competitor or the same company, they'll take you back. And that works for me. So I don't believe it's career suicide unless you absolutely do nothing. So when you're quitting, my recommendation is I call like the moment you know that you're going to quit, right? Let's say like it's over, right? Like, yeah. what tactically do I do? Right. And I follow these steps. The first thing that I do, the first mentality that I have is I'm Positive Pam. That's my name. I don't give any feedback. I don't say, oh, here's how I would improve the company. Once I've sort of stated that I'm quitting, I'm no longer trying to make the company that I'm with better, because there's this tendency to say, oh, I left now. Like, I'll write an email how this, because I care so much. I'm like, you know, if I were you, I would do X, Y, Z. And you always look like an asshole, because never be Superman on the way out from the company. If you wanted to fix the problems, stay there and fix the problems and then leave. Don't recommend fixes that you couldn't fix in the first place because you care about the company. Mm-hmm. And so that's a big mistake people make. Two is that, you know, when I'm leaving, when I send my resignation email, and like, as you know, like my resignation email was sent by the CEO of Deloitte Consulting to the entire company. My I'm leaving the company email was sent to the entire company, entire Deloitte Consulting company, which is like 10,000 plus people. It was a lot of people.
Why? It's like, look at this jerk.
Yeah. Like, don't ever quit like this. You know, because I actually had a good time when I was working at Deloitte, and I had a lot of great mentors and friends there. And so in my email, I just said, you know, here are the people that I appreciate working with. Here's why I appreciate working with them. Thank you very much for the time. You know, hopefully we catch up, you know, in the near future. And what's funny is I sent an email to like 40 people, right? I was only with the company like 3 years, and I forwarded it to the CEO of Deloitte Consulting, who I've never met ever. I just liked him. And then another managing director, her name is Janet Foudy, and I believe she's now the CEO of Deloitte Consulting.
Okay.
Because he became, so Puneet Renjan was the CEO. He became the global chairman of the board and CEO of Deloitte, which is like 150,000, I think 200,000 plus. He oversaw 200,000 plus people. He sent my email to the entire company when I was there, because he liked it. But I forwarded it to him, say, hey, I'm leaving. You know, I just want to say, here are the people I appreciate on the way out. You know, hopefully you can recognize them during the next like performance.
So it was completely a thank you for the great experience.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I really appreciated working with these people. There was no, you know, you should do this or that or the other thing better.
No, I was like, oh, I wasn't saying please send to the company at your earliest convenience, you know? And so, and it was pretty informal email. Like, I mean, I was making jokes about people, you know, inside the email. And so it wasn't like a PR, you know, Robbie's decided to step down.
If people want to read this, where can they find it?
On my website, firemeatbaggy.com, or just send me an email to Robbie@firemeatbaggy.com with the subject, resignation letter, or go F yourself, Robbie. And I'll still send it anyway. And I'll forward the resignation email that he sent out, plus some other tips.
Okay. Yeah. It's cool. It's like the same phenomenon that makes a LinkedIn post go viral, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Is good stuff.
Yeah. Virtue signaling. It's like, you know, it's positive.
I'm good.
I'm good. Right. Yeah. I'm good. You're good. You know, this is the way we should do things.
You're good. Yeah, exactly. Huh. So in the exit interview, even then, what do you do then?
Yeah, I lie. I lie during exit interviews.
There you go. Robbie Abed says lie in your exit interview.
Yeah. It's lie in your exit interview, but never lie in your resume, but lie like hell in exit interview. So if you're not familiar with the exit interview, it's, you know, after you get fired or decide to leave, you get a chance to talk to HR. And for many people, this is like, oh, the HR is asking like, what would we improve? You know, do you have any feedback, et cetera? And oh, by the way, it's 100% confidential. It won't leave. We have strict policies. That's false. So always false. Somehow, really? Some way, you know, through informal conversations or whatever, the feedback will get back to your manager you know? And so that's why I recommend always being positive, Pam, never really giving them constructive feedback on it, because the world is very small and you're probably going to run into these people 2 or 3 years later. So, you know, if I had, there's one job I was at where I just despised my manager. I hated this person. And it took every bone in my body not to tell this person off, you know, but I kept it in, you know, the exit interview. I didn't say a damn thing about this person, even though I could have. And then, you know, this person ended up turning into like a business opportunity like 2 years later, you know? And so
was this a context in which you didn't have to work with this person that you hated, but
exactly. Yes, exactly. Like I would never
work. So that person gave you a connection, but,
they were a potential opportunity for me later on. I didn't know at the time. I didn't know what it was, but mm-hmm. a few years later, we still keep in touch. I'm good with keeping in touch. And, you know, and so it turned into a business opportunity for in the future. But but all because I restrained from just saying thank you for screwing me, you know.
Well, one thing that you mentioned earlier was if you want to fix problems in the company, stay and fix them.
Right.
So if you do feel like you would be glad if people fired you, if your boss fired you, I'm probably not just a random person on the street's going to fire you. You're fired. Like,
I've never been fired by three people at once.
Never been fired by somebody who I don't work for.
Yeah. Right.
So if you wish that they fired you,
yeah.
Is there some point where you should look at yourself and say, well, can I change things?
So the first thing I do is once you understand that you need to quit, right? And I don't recommend doing it right away, but you just said at some point in the very near future, I need to get out of this hellhole. What I recommend are a few things. One is every time you need to separate your work from your life, like immediately. And so the first thing that I do is when I come into the office, I purposely come in through the back door. I don't go in the front door. I don't say, hey, Jan and Joanne and Mike. I say hi to nobody. I completely distance myself from the work that I'm doing. And so I come in through like the back door, just because I don't want people to know when I'm coming. I don't want to know what people I'm leaving. I sort of want to set the expectation that, you know, if I don't decide to come into work, people aren't going to like, they're not going to, it's not going to raise any red flags. I'm going to set a new sort of type of standard. The second thing I do is I change my mindset from how do I get an exceeding expectations? Like, how do I like blow this rule out of the water and do a great job to how do I get a meets expectations? So I just change my entire, that would find me, I would change people to a meets expectations.
Okay. So at first, you're kind of working on changing. At first, you're working on changing the expectations of how you arrive and leave work. And that's so it doesn't arouse suspicion if you suddenly stop going, or how?
It's more of a mental thing. It's like separating yourself. Like, cause what happens is you get so involved in the job, you forget about everything else. Like you're in too deep.
Yeah.
You know, and so you start thinking, oh, my work is really important. I have to do all these things. And my first sort of mental trick, and that's what I say, is like come through the back door, or if you have family pictures, like take off the family pictures, is that you are not your job.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and you are there for a specific reason. And so you need to get your head out of your ass and say, this is just a job, not what I'm going to be doing long term.
You're separating it from your identity. You're untangling it from your identity, yes. Which can be part of where the fear comes from, is that your identity is wrapped up in having a job, in it being this job, and I'm going to miss my coworkers.
Right. Exactly. And so it's a difference between I'm about to leave the office and I get an email at 4:59 say, hey, Robbie, do this. Old Robbie. Oh, let me stay late. Let me do this for you. New Robbie is I just go home. I answer it Tuesday morning, you know? Say, so, oh, just saw the email. Hope it's not too late. Here you go.
Mm-hmm.
It's that little thing right there where it's just a mental shift. And I've got feedback from that has helped people sort of distance themselves and make changes, because it allows them to see this is not permanent.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like when the boss that I used to work with and the one that I thought was going to fire me, you know, she never had it, her desk was always empty, always. And it just felt like she was ready to go at any time. You know what I mean? You know what I mean? It was like some people have like their family photos and they have all these awards and it's like they look like they're going to be there forever. She it just like, she just, but she was really good at what she does. Mm-hmm. But she just like distanced herself. And I took me a while to notice like you've got nothing here. You know, you have established career of nothing on your desk, you know, and the time it took me time to realize like, oh, she's ready to go at any time, you know? And so I kind of learned from now, like, yeah, I think everyone should just be ready to go. And that's how you build up a better career.
It's also a good opportunity to maybe test out some of the things that you've thought about mm-hmm. before, where maybe you would have answered that email or maybe that email comes at 7 p.m.
Yeah.
And you're at home and you go and do the thing. And it's a situation where the request is downright, you know, clearly right. unreasonable outside of the right. of the normal agreement of employment. And mm-hmm. you, in the past, maybe felt like you had to do that and worried about what horrible consequences there would right. be for you not responding to an email at 7 p.m. Now you can try it on.
Right. Yeah.
So there's that too, and that can help you in your future job, perhaps.
Yeah, and what I learned from that was, I mean, for other projects I was on after that, you know, I try like what would happen if I don't bring my laptop home, like what happens if I don't have internet access, like, connection to my email, and long story short, nothing happened. Everything was great. Everything worked out fine. Mm-hmm. I was like, oh, I can do this. I can just go home. And I think in a 6-month project, I took my laptop home once.
Yeah.
And that was just because we were like, it was like a big day to go live with the project, but that was it.
And maybe even at that point, if things are working out fine, maybe you just decide that you're changing your relationship with your career in general and you're yeah. staying at the job, but you're finding something outside of it that's making you hate your life less.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. And I think the big thing is that why I tell people to the new thing is to just to do meets expectations. Is because a lot of times people go above and beyond and they still get to meet expectations. You know what I mean? Like it doesn't actually help them. So like imagine you just did not like the bare minimum.
You're referring to meet expectations in the
annual performance
review. In your performance review.
Right.
So right.
My thing is you're going, the moment you know that you're going to quit, the motivation to get exceeds performance, whatever, or exceeds expectations should go out the window.
Yeah.
Meets expectations. You're going to be an average worker. Because a lot of people that get burnt out are people that are like high performers and they don't like the power and the people are slowing them down. You know, those are the people that are like have the motivation to leave. That's what I was like, just change your mindset to meets expectations. Chances are no one's going to notice.
Yeah.
You know? And you could probably save 20 hours a week just doing that.
Start to kind of check out your meets yeah. expectations. Maybe you got the money saved up. Mm. Maybe you're deciding to change your relationship with your career, or maybe you're deciding to leave the job.
Yeah.
And so once you've gotten to the meets expectations part, is there something you should do after that?
After you've decided to that you're going to do meets expectations?
I mean, you make that adjustment. Mm-hmm. You make this adjustment and now you're leaving every day at 5.
Yeah. I mean, the obvious next step is what am I going to do with this extra energy? Mm-hmm. What else can I explore? Because when people quit, very rarely do they quit knowing what they're going to do next. Mm-hmm. All they know is they don't want to do this. You know what I mean? And so use that time to read, explore, be creative. You know, what else can I do? That's why I recommend going to coffee meetings. You know, instead of coming to the office at 9 o'clock, take a coffee meeting at 9 o'clock or going to lunch or whatever else. Just slip out the back door, meet with those people, you know, the people that are outside of your job, and who have different careers, things like that, and ask what they're doing, ask for their input, like what they would do. So I would just use that time for exploration.
What's the pretense of the coffee meetings? Is it, oh, hey, you're in a career that I am interested in? Or is it really just let's have coffee and have no agenda? Are people getting less and less up for agendaless coffee meetings?
Or? Yeah, I think there's recently I've seen a lot of people like totally against it. Like one of my people that I've been listening to and I've told you about, Naval, hates coffee meetings.
Yeah.
He thinks it's like the biggest time sink.
I do one every once in a while, but if you want an agendaless coffee, you know, or cold intros, I hate that stuff.
Right. Yeah. I think you hate it because you have a very, you know what you want and you know, like you have a path of the people that you need to meet to get where you're at. Right. And I think when I was connecting with these startup founders, we were all sort of in the same boat, which is let's just meet with people that are like us and talk about these like-minded things. Now I take coffee meetings. They're much more targeted, which is like, hey, I want to interview you.
Yeah.
Let's have coffee. That works out great. Or, you know, people reach out to me like, hey, I've got a problem with a career. Can you talk to my son? Or sure. Set up time with me. Let's talk.
Yeah. If there's a clear way that you can help a person with something, then sometimes that can make it more appealing as well.
Exactly.
So is that something that you might ask if you're inviting people to coffee?
I'll tell them this is what my expectations are. I think the higher they are in the chain, like the more, either more senior they are or maybe even how older they are, they protect their time a lot more.
Yeah.
When you're younger, I think we've forgotten when we're younger is let's meet. Let's talk. What's out there? Let's meet new people. Now it's like, well, we're getting a little more like, what do you want from me now? Like we're very suspicious. Like you want to meet me? Why?
Yeah.
What's in it for me? You know, and I kind of hate that a little bit. It's kind of like, well, let's figure out who the people that we can help or connect with.
Well, you do that too much and you will stagnate.
Yes.
I love what I heard from Dan Ariely on a podcast interview once, which was that he said that he does some small amounts of things that make no sense.
Yeah.
Because you never know what sort of random opportunities come from it or black swans,
right,
et cetera. And so you got to like mix in a little bit of that.
Right.
And it just can constantly looking to try to get something out of every action that you take.
Yeah.
But you can't necessarily be floating in the wind all the time.
Right. You got
stuff you got to do, you know?
Yeah, no, exactly. And so I think when what's funny is when there's a founder. He recently quit. He was a founder of a company, quit his job, traveled the world, and I reached out to him and, let's set up some time to get coffee. Oh, sorry. I said, let's set up time to get coffee. And, he sent me back his phone number. He goes, call me anytime. I'm unemployed. I go, oh, I'm going to start using that more often. So when we have time, we don't have a job or something to do, we're totally open to exploring. So when I did my 250 coffee meetings, I was unemployed essentially. I had no idea what I would do with my life. We were all unemployed.
Yeah.
We were all startup founders. You know, we're all trying to figure it out. Then we're all like, what do we need agenda for? Like, you seem like a cool person. And again, we've also met face to face, but I'm all for agenda-less coffee meetings.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to take it.
I aspire to be somebody who's available and interruptible all the time. Someday that's like my life's dream is to.
But what do you mean by that? Like,
I think that I tweeted this the other day that like it used to be the status symbol to be like busy. I'm so busy. I just don't have time for anything. I can't whatever. But I think, not that it's about status, but like, I believe that in the future, the status symbol will be like, just, you know, call me anytime or whatever. Yeah. Or to be interruptible.
I like that. Yeah. Cause I think cause to be interruptible, like for stuff that means have your money situation, like you're financially secure. Mm-hmm. So that you're confident that you're going to continue to get money. And two, it's kind of like, Naval always talks about every person wants freedom, peace. You know, that's all we want is like peace in our life and just the freedom. We want the freedom to do whatever
he wants.
Naval
has his own podcast. So you don't need to tell us.
So, Naval Ravikant, I think that's to be interruptible. I think it's a sign for you. I think if I have to diagnose you, that you have the time to just do whatever.
Well, I think it's also that the more that you need to be creative, the more that you need to be open to serendipity and these sort of random things that happen. Like if you are a bricklayer, then yeah, you wouldn't be laying bricks all day long. You're getting paid by the brick.
Right.
But if you're creative, then you kind of have to have this periods of reverie where your mind is floating around, and yeah, maybe you randomly meet some people or get interrupted a bit, but you've got to have some way to turn that into something. Mm-hmm. However, I think there's some volatility to it where, you know, sometimes it works, usually it doesn't.
Right.
but in the end it evens out.
Yeah. And I think the struggle is as a former workaholic, it sounds very easy to say, oh, just, you know, work less, work smarter, you know, and things will work itself out and get enough sleep. And it all sounds great. And I think it is accurate. I think there's, for me, a lot of people that I've met, and even myself, it's just hard to figure out how do I get there where I have this time to do things, and not be a workaholic. And so I've been a workaholic for a big part of my life.
How workaholic are we talking about?
You know, like I'd work 13-hour days, 14-hour days every day for like 3 months straight.
Yeah.
And now it's not sustainable at all.
Yeah.
But I felt like at the time when I'm in it that I have to do it. For whatever reason, I'm motivated or inspired or just dumb enough to say, I have to do this.
You don't get to a point where you're like, I'm being less productive now because I'm spending so much time doing this.
I do once I stop. Once I like stop the working so much.
Yeah.
And I step back going, okay, well, then I figure like, what do I need to do so I don't do what I just did? Do I need to hire people? Do I need to like just, you know, raise my prices and fire like half of my clients? These are conversations I have like to this day. Hell, this morning. You know what I mean? It's like, I've got plenty of options of what I can do with my business. Which one is the right one? But I know I don't want to get back to the working 80 hours a week. And I can't say fire me, I beg you, because it's my business. You know what I mean? I gotta just fire.
Can't escape now.
Right, yeah.
Well, yeah, when you're in the muck, it does seem difficult to find the time, but it's always after like, you take a week of vacation or something, you come back and suddenly it's very clear like, oh, that thing that I was going to do is a waste of time. I'm not going to do it. I'm going to do this thing. And then slowly entropy takes over and you become a mess within a couple months again. But if you can put some things in place to prevent that, then...
And if you can do that, that's great.
Yeah.
You know, I think it just takes your time to get to that state.
That for me is systems.
Yeah.
Is just having a system that I follow, like for producing the podcast. It's a lot more predictable, and that's maybe when you don't have clients. I think what you're referring to is you're doing a lot of writing for clients, but that can still have a systems component to it. It's like, oh, I'm doing a writing thing, or people who, you know, productize consulting is that way, where you can just have a system of like, okay, these are the units that I sell, and this is my process for doing those units, and this is my timeline for doing those, and you don't have to think about any of it other than carrying it out. And each time you do it better, and that works.
A lot of it is it's all about setting expectations, like with, you know, the people that you work with and even yourself.
Yeah.
You know, if I just set better expectations, like it's going to cost this much. I'm only going to do XYZ and I will deliver that. I have a tendency. Whenever I have like free time and I'm like estimating something, I always think I could do more. Always. Like it's to this day, I'm like, oh, I could do all that, you know? And then I'm like, oh, then I was like, what the fuck was I thinking? Or my other
planning fallacy.
Yeah. Or my other employees like, yo, what? You signed what? You know, like, this is going to be, and I'm like, no, it won't be that bad. And then like real life happens. I go, fuck, I shouldn't have done that, you know? And so that's an area I'm still working on.
I mean, it kind of explains why we're in this podcast booth right now and why it took us 45 minutes to get set up. You're like, oh, it'll be okay. I'm like, I think I'm going to bring some of my own equipment as a backup. You're like, oh, come on, David. You're so
Yeah.
Why are you always so prepared or something?
And yeah. Then, yeah.
I mean, we did figure it out though.
But that's the thing.
We did.
We always figure it out. So that's my mentality.
I love always. All right. Well, this has been fun. Mm-hmm. I enjoyed being in the booth.
This is great. I think we need like a picture, someone taking a picture of us in the booth.
It was awesome chatting with you. I hope that everybody who's listening quits their job. No, not everybody, yeah. But somebody. And if they
if you want to quit your job, quit your job.
Yeah, and we can see if we can get a picture of us in the booth. It'd be fun to see, but I don't know.
Are you claustrophobic or no? Is it?
No, I'm not.
Yes, basically. Yeah.
Well, by Fire Me, I Beg You. And what else should people do?
Add me on LinkedIn.
Add you on LinkedIn. No, Twitter.
I don't.
You're a LinkedIn guy.
Twitter, I just don't. I don't like getting in people's conversations.
Yeah.
I think it's a time sink. I don't like it.
Okay. Well, you're on there enough.
I am. I've started actually.
Robbie Abed on Twitter.
Robbieab. Yeah. Just.
Oh, okay. Robbie Ab. Like.
Yeah.
Abdominals. All right. Well, thank you so much for being on the show.
Is Love Your Work helping you find your unique creative voice? Does it bring you the inspiration and motivation you need to become the creator and human you want to be? If so, please be a part of making this a special and nourishing and thoughtful show. Support the show on Patreon. You'll be an even bigger part of the show than you already are. If you contribute just a coffee a month, you'll be helping support the hosting and production of Love Your Work. Everyone has some unique creative gift to offer the world. Together, we can give people the tools they need to bring that work into the world. The world will be better off for it. Visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/Katavi. This is a different kind of model for supporting the work that you love. The choice is yours. Vote with your dollars, put your money where your mind is, and keep Love Your Work going. Visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/Katavi. As a thank you, you'll get early access, bonus content, and a discount on Love Your Work merchandise. Learn more at patreon.com/Katavi. That's patreon.com/KADAVY. And if you can't support the show financially and you've listened to at least 3 episodes, can you do me a favor? Write a review on Apple Podcasts. You can consider it your donation to help support the show. Love Your Work is brought to you in part by our Patreon supporters, such as mini sponsor Paula Spriggs, and top supporters such as Jeffrey Mason and Vitas Pinkovicius. This has been Love Your Work, and I'm David Katavi. The theme music for this show is At Sea by Durena from the album About Everything and More by arrangement with Deep Elm Records at deepelm.com. Love Your Work is a production of Katavi, Inc.